thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we talk about your pet's health. And certainly, sure, we're going to be talking about the mysterious new respiratory virus that is affecting dogs in some parts of the country. We're joined by Dr. Maria Verbrugge. She's a clinical instructor of primary care at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Maria, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
Also with us is Dr. Amy Nicholson. She's a clinical assistant professor of primary care at UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Amy, thank you for joining us by Meet today. Good to see your face.
Good to see you. Happy to be here.
And I've been told that you have brought along an expert to make sure that nothing gets missed. Vanilla Bean, I believe. Is that correct?
That is right. She is my little 4.5-pound white dog who is sitting on my lap as we speak. Yes.
So Vanilla Bean is also one of our guests, but I don't think we'll hear much from Vanilla Bean during the show. Both doctors are practicing veterinarians as well and see patients through the UW Veterinary Care's primary care service. So as we talk with these two, I hope you'll join in. What do you do to prepare your dog for winter, perhaps? What other pet questions, health questions, are on your mind? I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Maria, let's start with you. That new illness, there's a kind of a mysterious respiratory illness that's been observed in dogs in some parts of the country. It's, I guess, similar to kennel cough?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of news reports and a lot of news stories about this. So what we can say is several states are investigating cases of infectious cough in dogs that are just standing out because they're lasting longer than usual, just taking longer to recover, maybe a little bit more severe than usual. What we are seeing is low mortality, meaning we're not seeing larger numbers of dogs dying of infectious respiratory disease, but just having a little bit more severe clinical signs. So for background, canine infectious respiratory disease complex is our fancy term for kennel cough. And there's probably 12 or 15 or so pathogens that are big players. So just like in humans, we might have an adenovirus or a rhinovirus, and either one we would just call a cold. Dogs have a bunch of different pathogens that can cause infectious cough. So it's a little bit of an exercise in kind of how the media reports on science. The media is kind of describing this as a new virus, or maybe I've seen it described as a new type of bacteria that isn't responding to antibiotics. And none of that's really been confirmed yet. And in fact, lots of pathogens are viruses, and so we don't expect them to respond to antibiotics. We don't commonly use antibiotics in infectious cough in dogs.
I did look at, I was watching the news, the national news, and they had a little short video of a dog who had it.
Yeah.
Didn't look too happy about it either.
Right. Yeah. And certainly, you know, as with humans with a cold, they can be pretty miserable. They can have a loud hacking cough that kind of keeps us awake at night. And they can definitely, especially when they are in close quarters, like in shelters or in boarding kennels or in daycare situations, they can definitely transmit that pretty quickly amongst each other. So for the groups that are doing the investigating around the country, they haven't really even entirely agreed on a case definition for what they're studying, probably meaning that different groups around the country are seeing something slightly different. So that does make the studying more complicated. So if one group is looking at a set of dogs that maybe have infectious cough, but some of them seem more severe than others, they're probably looking at groups of dogs that mostly have kind of our garden variety group of infectious respiratory disease, sort of searching around for that needle in the haystack to find out if there's something new. And so it is pretty complicated. The groups are definitely talking to each other. They are sharing samples. So the smart science people are doing their smart science stuff. For now, I don't think that they've, you know, confirmed, is there a new virus? Is there a bacteria? Is there a little bit more severe strain of something that we already knew about? But for now, stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, we're going to keep our eye on this.
And then, it's not something we're going to get that I'm going to get sick from if I or anybody else if they're in contact with that.
There's certainly not been any evidence of that at all. The pathogens that go between dogs and people are very uncommon.
And what about, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was saying, well, and what about if the, you know, your dog starts showing those kinds of symptoms mm-hmm. that you described, should we be doing anything about it?
Yeah, so first and foremost, we're going to keep doing all of the things that we should have hopefully been doing all along. So if your dog is showing signs of illness, you're going to keep him home. Not go socialize with other dogs until at least a week after he's feeling better. We're going to keep doing the vaccines that your vet recommends for your dog's lifestyle. So dogs that go to daycare, dogs that are really social, are going to have, you know, probably more vaccines. We're going to want to do more of the kennel cough types of vaccines. And then, you know, for your holiday travel, that means have a backup plan, because if your dog happens to get sick right before you're about to travel, you're not going to be able to send him to the kennel. And also, you know, we're going to keep balancing our dog's mental health with their physical health. And so we're definitely not recommending that dogs just, you know, stay home and don't socialize at all, because it's pretty important.
Yeah. And that reminds me, maybe turn to Dr. Amy Dr. Amy Nicholson for this. It is cold. Boy, I found that out this morning at about 6 o'clock on my little jog around the neighborhood. And I was thinking about dogs, and there were fewer than normal out there. And you've got snow, you got ice, you got salt. And I'm thinking paws to begin with. I rarely see a dog with those booties or whatever they are.
Booties?
Yeah, and I've talked to some people, and they said, well, I tried to get the booty on the dog and chewed him off immediately or whatever. So how do you protect your dog's paws?
Yeah, I think that's such an important question as it gets into the, you know, low teens as we had this morning. And we have to worry about protecting dogs' paws, not only from the cold and the ice that kind of, you know, if you have a relatively thick-haired dog, they may tolerate the winter fine, but if they're getting those little ice snow conglomerations on their feet, that can get them really cold. And likewise, like you mentioned, the salt on the road, and as we get snow and all the salt, can be really abrasive to their paws. So a nice booty can be very helpful. It is not always easy to get them to tolerate a booty well. And so that's where training, often if you get a dog from a puppy, it's really helpful to start training early and often to just put on the booties, give them a treat, take them off, try one at a time, and finding the booty that works best for your dog. So ideally they'd have traction, they'd be well fitted, not too tight. And most successful booties have like a Velcro connector, so that you can cater the tightness to that dog. And so those tend to be the most successful booties. But if your dog is doing a lot of walking outside in the snow and salt, it is worth trying to do a booty on them, especially if they're going for long periods of activity.
Well, I'm just wondering, how are those chemicals in salt and so forth, or salt-type solutions that are put out there, are they dangerous for dogs?
So certainly they are not good, right? We certainly wouldn't want dogs like licking off the salt or the dirt. Not only could it cause, you know, dietary indiscretion, but it can cause electrolyte imbalances as well if done excessively. So that's a great point, Larry, where we also don't want them walking around in the salt and the coming back and licking all their paws and having that causing some gastrointestinal upset.
You know, if it was me, I don't have a dog, but if it was me, I think I'd want to almost take the dog to the store with me, or at least have a chance to physically look at the booties, frankly, rather than buy them online and then maybe have to return them.
Yeah, I mean, they do have sizing charts, if you do go to the store, it's still helpful to like take a little measuring tape, and they have sizing charts for their paws and their wrist and their ankle sizes that you can measure. But absolutely, you know, especially assuming your dog is up to date on vaccines, as Dr. Verbrugge mentioned, you know, you don't want them going to the pet store nose to nose with other dogs if they're not properly vaccinated. But they could certainly go and try on the booties at the store. And then they have the pleasure of wearing them out and showing off to everybody.
Oh, talking with Dr. Amy Nicholson and Dr. Maria Verbrugge today about your pet's health. We started on sort of that new I don't even know if I want to call it new. I should say the respiratory ailment that is affecting some dogs around the country, and getting some winter tips. There's one more that comes to mind. My good friend has a dog that came from Texas, and I'm not sure appreciates going outside to go. And if she goes outside, she runs outside. She'll run outside, go very quickly, and run back in, essentially. Are there ways that, you know, you want the dog to have some exercise, too? I suppose the booties would be a help, and probably a coat.
Yeah, absolutely. So depending on the dogs, so first of all, you raised a great point, which is some dogs do not like the cold, right? So even, you know, some dogs who just don't like it, it can be really challenging. And that's where like winter wear comes into play. So not only the booties, but the coats, the jackets, the sweaters, depending on what the weather is like, may be beneficial to help keep your dog comfortable in the colder weather if they do need to go outside. In general, you know, those thick coated dogs, the winter breed dogs, they may not need a coat, but even they, if they're spending a long period of time in sedentary conditions outside, need like an insulated area to kind of an insulated shelter to stay protected. But your, you know, Chihuahuas, your small dogs, your puppies, and your geriatric dogs probably need some external heat support if they're going to be spending a prolonged period of time outside under the freezing conditions.
You know, that brings to mind something else. That you know, we're well aware that you do not want your dog in the warm days of summer to be sitting in the car by itself. I'm wondering about the winter. What about the winter and having your dog sitting in the car?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same conditions. If your car is getting into the 20s or 30s, you know, I went out to my car yesterday after work and it was 25. Yeah. That can certainly be too cold for a dog to be sitting in because the weather has a lot to do with their activity level. You know, if they're out and running, it doesn't matter as much if it's 20 degrees because they're burning off their and they're staying warm at a core level. But if they're sedentary, all of a sudden that cold makes a bigger difference.
We will be taking your questions and comments, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. With us from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Amy Nicholson and Dr. Maria Verbrugge. I'm Larry Mueller. Trina LaSousa is our engineer. Clara Neipert, our producer for the Ideas Network. Here to answer your pet health questions, Dr. Amy Nicholson and Dr. Maria Verbrugge from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Both have extensive, professors, but they are also right there every day treating animals at the UW Veterinary Clinic. So we will take a call from Ruth in Eau Claire right now. Let's go there. Ruth, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling because in our area, we're definitely seeing, and I've heard this from veterinarians, both who are doing regular practice and others that are doing emergency care, that there's definitely an increase in kennel cough, respiratory illness. Our own dog, who's 2.5, and he was vaccinated the 1st of December, 2023, so just a few months ago, he was vaccinated for Bordetella, but he's got whatever this is, and he is now entering his second round of antibiotics because we haven't gotten the symptoms, and usually with kennel cough, you get it with one round of antibiotics, and that's not happening here. Our own vet is saying it's taking 2 to 3 rounds of antibiotics, and not all the dogs are making it. So I don't know why this isn't better known, people really have to be careful right now.
Oh, Ruth, thank you for calling. Dr. Maria, comment.
Yeah, so part of that is it kind of getting back to that infectious, the canine infectious respiratory disease complex. Lots of different things will cause that infectious cough. And so sometimes those antibiotics are, you know, not nearly as useful as we would hope they would be if it turns out that the dog has a viral cause. Sometimes dogs will also have another underlying reason of why this particular dog is having trouble clearing an infection. Sometimes our flat-faced dogs, older dogs, any dog that's on any kind of like immunosuppressive medication or has other inflammatory lung diseases, they can take a lot longer to clear an infectious cough. So there's so many different factors that go into that. One resource that is available is if you do want to identify what pathogen might be causing this, this particular case, is there are panels that can be sent off to look for lots and lots of different pathogens. Those can be sent to the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, but there's other labs that can do that as well. And so that can be really useful if you are, you know, seeing a population of dogs that are sick, and then you want to know how can I target this more, more specifically. So that would be a resource. But again, you know, keep working with your veterinarian. Sometimes you need to look a little deeper and try to find out, you know, what's going on that's different here. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for that call. Appreciate it very much. Different kind of question from Penny in Eltura, Minnesota. Hi, Penny.
Well, hi there. So I have a cat who's probably 12, 13 years old. He was a feral cat originally. I took him to the vet about a week and a half ago. He had he was salivating, had a swollen, inflamed gum by his canine. So my vet put him on 5 days of Umbrellin, I think is the name of the med. And he did get some pretty severe stinky diarrhea. So I picked up, last weekend, I picked up some, like a probiotic from the vet, by Purina for him. And I've been giving him that. But I've noticed he's been throwing up. He's been vomiting once or twice a day, say the last 4 or 5 days. And I was wondering
what that might be. Yeah. Dr. Amy?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that, Penny. Is he still on the antibiotics, can I ask?
No, he was
on the medication.
And he finished it up last Wednesday, a week ago tomorrow.
Okay. Okay. But now the diarrhea has, it sounds like, improved with the probiotic, but now we're vomiting 1 to 2 times a day.
Yes.
So, you know, I think... Okay. So, you know, occasionally we'll see the adverse reaction to the probiotic if their stomach is just a little bit too sensitive for that kind of probiotic or some of the components of it. However, you know, I definitely think this warrants a conversation with your vet just to make sure that we're not missing something else that could be causing him to vomit 1 or 2 times a day, especially when it's been going on for the last 4 days. You know, I think that making sure that we're not missing something is important.
Good luck, Penny. Thank you so much for calling. I was just thinking about this because my cat Coco has been vomiting for the past 4 days a couple of times a day, but we also put up a Christmas tree, and he likes to eat the needles. So he does that about twice a day.
It is the season. Yes.
Definitely the season.
That's
for
where
that.
Just making sure nothing else, is going on, because they love to get into that. And sometimes it just causes indiscretion, like a little needle. But sometimes if it's tinsel or things like that, it can cause big problems.
Yeah, I don't put tinsel on just for partly for
either.
That reason. You can join in too with your questions. What about your pet's health? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Wanted to talk about sleeping for a bit, not my own, but my own gets affected by my cat sleeping for sure. But getting the right amount of sleep, I mean, do cats and dogs kind of know, or what, Dr. Amy?
Yeah, I think cats or dogs tend to know how much sleep they want to get. And just like you or I, we have different sleep preferences and sleep allowances too, based on our jobs and our other obligations. But I think the biggest concern would be, it's very normal for cats and dogs to sleep throughout the day, to nap, and then to sleep at night. That's very typical. We know that younger dogs and older dogs tend to sleep more. The bigger concern would be ever if your dog or cat is sleeping unusually. So what I mean by that is if all of a sudden their sleep habits change, they're up all night pacing, they're sleeping more during the day, or they seem like they're lethargic or under the weather. Or if they're starting to make sounds when they sleep. So if they sound audible, snoring, kind of like raspy when they're sleeping. Sometimes, especially our flat-faced dogs, like our bulldogs or our pugs, will get actually sleep apnea, similar to some humans. And so isolating that, recognizing that, can be important to manage it early.
So if the dog or the cats are acting weird when it comes to sleep, do you take them to the vet then, or what do you do?
Yeah, in general, if it seems like there's something unusual, it doesn't hurt to talk to your vet and just see what's going on, especially if you're noticing, that they're sleeping more than they used to. If they seem like they're just sleeping normally, they've always just been a sleeper, I wouldn't worry too much about it. Certainly there are certain things you can do to try to encourage a sleeping environment. So we assume that, similar to humans, that exercise during the day, things like that, setting up a nice comfortable and dark place can be helpful for sleeping. And the other thing that we already know a lot in humans, but it's also true in dogs or cats, is that having a separate place to sleep can encourage sleeping soundly. So when we sleep with our animals, as I am guilty of, sometimes that can hinder not only our sleep, but their sleep as well.
Yeah, Coco likes to run around at night, and then about midnight likes to come up next to my head and wake me up.
Yes.
And want to be warm right next to me.
Yes, and that is the different lifestyle, the different circadian rhythm of cats versus humans. And so you are finding that out. My cat does the same thing. She loves to play at 11 p.m. at night. She just starts running down the halls. And so that's very normal for a cat, but cannot be pleasurable for us.
Susan in Michigan's UP has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 13-month-old mini Labradoodle. I feel the tartar is building up more than usual on her teeth. I have started brushing twice a day. I'm wondering what else I can do.
Well, I would say if you are brushing twice a day, that is absolutely fantastic. Brushing is by far the best thing that we can do. There are dental chews and things like that, dental diets. But by far, brushing is often the most difficult, but definitely the best. So if you're already seeing tartar at your dog's young age already, you may just have a dog who is a little bit more genetically predisposed to dental disease, unfortunately. And our small breed dogs, that is definitely something that we see. So I would say you could certainly add in things like the dental diets, which have cross-linked fibers that, as the dog chews the kibble up, will additionally kind of help to clean the teeth. if you are seeing, you know, if you're, you know, going in to see your vet on a regular basis, your vet should be able to, you know, let you know when it looks like it's time to actually do anesthesia and do a whole comprehensive, you know, oral exam under anesthesia and do a full cleaning. And a lot of times after that full cleaning, when we start up brushing, it kind of works a little better because we're starting from a much cleaner surface. So hopefully that helps. And yeah, keep up the good work.
Do they have, greenies exist for dogs?
Yeah, they sure do. And those are, so for a list of things where there is good evidence that they actually work, the Veterinary Oral Health Council has a website and has a list of things that they've looked at the evidence for whether they work or not. So that's a good place, a good resource to look at.
I may have told this story before, but the vet told me that tiger's teeth, you need to do something about the teeth. And of course, I can't brush the teeth. So I installed greenies into the diet, which she loves. And the next year, when I took her back for her yearly, she said, "Oh my gosh," the vet says, "what did you do? Her teeth are clean."
Wow.
So they really worked, in at least for Tiger.
At least in that one case, that's awesome.
Susan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Amy in Bailey's Harbor, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi there. I had my dogs were up here in Door County with me all fall, and it was a very ticky fall, apparently. And they each got multiple tick bites. So I took them into the vet to have them titered, and one came up positive for anaplasmosis. She said, "Well, you can put them on a month of doxycycline, two pills twice a day for a month, but it may not clear it up completely. It may still test positive." I'm not sure I've not ever heard much about anaplasmosis, and it's one of the tick-borne illnesses, but I don't really know what it you know, how worried should I be?
And are there any, what's the positive versus false positive on anaplasmosis? I'd be interested in that too. So a few things there to bring up.
So thanks for that.
Go ahead, Amy.
I'll just jump in.
Go ahead.
I'm just going at it. Perfect. So I'm sorry that you had so many tick bites. It has been like a rough season, I think, for ticks over the summer. Certainly anaplasma is a tick-borne disease that we see not as commonly as some other tick-borne diseases in this area, like Lyme disease, but we don't see it uncommonly either. And so as long as your dog is not showing any clinical signs of disease, that's really encouraging. And signs that we look at are things like weakness, limping, swollen, painful joints or lymph nodes, quietness or lethargy, and then sometimes we'll see some blood changes on a blood count, because the anaplasma is actually an organism that can go into certain cells in the blood. And the test is a very good test. It tests for antibodies. And so what that means is kind of assessing whether or not the dog has been exposed. And so that's why your vet said even after a course of antibiotics, they're still going to test positive, is because it's actually just testing the body's response to it than actually the presence of the organism there. And so they can stay positive for a period of time, depending on how long the antibodies stay prevalent in the body. But as long as your dog is not showing signs, a lot of dogs don't. And so that's really encouraging.
Amy, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Mary in Dodgeville, who has a tick question as well. Mary, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. On the tick subject, that's interesting. Just this morning on my six-month-old kitten, we found a tick on his back. I pulled it out, and I got, I think, the body, but I'm not positive about the head. Should I be concerned?
Well, what do you think there, Amy? Dr. Amy Nicholson?
Yeah, I mean, it's always good to get the head out. Sometimes when the head is still present, it can either, you know, in a delayed fashion, like release some of the saliva, which could be irritating or problematic. Sometimes it'll get red or swollen around it. So I think it's worth seeing. Sometimes the body will just kind of extrude it on its own after it's been in there, but I would keep an eye on it for sure. Maybe call and just let your vet know. If it's starting to look irritated or raw, we may have to kind of try to help you get the head out. Sometimes if it just kind of goes away on its own, then that's okay too. I think you raised a really good point though, which is twofold. One is, you know, it's really important that our dogs and cats be on monthly flea and tick prevention all year round, right? It's, you know, 20 degrees outside and you're seeing a tick on your cat. And that's because as long as the ground is thawed, right, we're still going to see ticks. And so I think a lot of people say like, oh, seasonally in winter, we can be off of flea and tick preventative. And I think these two case examples are perfect that like, no, even in a cat, you know, especially if that cat's going outdoors for a period of time, they should be on year-round prevention to try to help mitigate tick bites and getting and preventing them from getting attached.
I was thinking about one of our former vets that used to appear on a program had a little tick remover that fit on her keychain. So she always kind of had it with her, and it was, you know, just a few inches long, and it was sort of forked.
I know just what you're talking about. Those are super handy, and there's a few different styles. There's some that are kind of like shaped like a spoon and have a little fork at the end. But yeah, it's ideally, you know, the first line of defense is going to be to have preventative on your dog or your cat. But those are a really handy tool for kind of lifting the full body of the tick off of the animal. And we can also use those on ourselves if we happen to be out in the woods and happen to find a tick that way as well.
Yeah, that was Dr. Sandy Sawchuk had that, and she had it with her all the time. So it was pretty cool. Mary, thank you so much, maybe get yourself one of those, what do they call them, tick removers or for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a bunch of different, probably cute little names for them. But
yeah, they can't be very expensive.
They are super handy.
Yeah.
Super. No, they're like a few dollars. Yeah. You just pull them out, straight out, very handy.
Mary, good luck. Thank you. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Sarah in Los Angeles, thanks for calling.
Hi there. Yeah, I've got a really food-obsessed 14-year-old schnoodle, and we've tried a lot of behavioral things, wondering if maybe there might be something medication-wise that we can do. I think it's getting so bad that she's got a lot of anxieties about food, and she's an anxiety-prone dog anyway, but she just cannot relax because she's always thinking about food and driving us nuts. It's driving her nuts. So, yeah, just wondering if there's anything either like appetite pill-wise or anxiety pill-wise that we could try.
So, Dr. Amy, we'll go to you.
So I think that can be such a frustrating situation. I too have some food-obsessed dogs, but it sounds like not as bad as yours. I think the first thing is really just to make sure there are some medical conditions that can cause more food obsession than historically. And so I think it's important, if you haven't already, to talk to your vet and just make sure that your kiddo doesn't have one of those food obsessed diseases that makes them more food obsessed. Otherwise, there's a lot of things that you can do to try to trigger and like alleviate the underlying cause. I've seen people use like snuffle mats where you kind of bring out the food, and so they have to kind of forage for the food, keeping them enriched, changing the food type to slow them down, feeding them like an automated feeder so they're getting multiple feedings throughout the day. So there's a lot of different ways to kind of spread out the food and make it feel like they're eating more, less more often, so that they're not getting more total calories per day. And then if it seems like it's not just a food thing, it's a general anxiety thing, then there's some things that we can help manage that too, both environmentally and sometimes pharmaceutically. But I think the first step is just making sure, especially since we're a little bit older, that there's not something else going on that's the underlying trigger for this change.
Yeah, makes good sense. Good luck, Sarah. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of emails, Christy and Madison emailed, are antiviral medications an option for dogs for this respiratory ailment that we were talking about earlier? So antiviral medications. What do you think, Dr. Maria?
That's a great question. It is, again, it is so often that when we treat a dog for upper respiratory infection that we treat them symptomatically just because there's so many different diseases in play, and we often don't take the time to diagnose exactly what they have. Oftentimes when we send off those tests, by the time the test results are back, the dog is doing better already. So that is one of the pesky things about testing. I think that we use antivirals in cats a little bit more often because cats have more problems with the viral upper respiratory disease that can kind of go become quite a bit more chronic. I haven't personally used them in dogs at all, so I'm not sure if some other veterinarians might find them more useful in that situation. But oftentimes these are the kind of garden variety kennel cough is just kind of runs its course, and we don't really necessarily need to. And a lot of times by the time we've figured out virus versus bacteria, the dog's on their way to recovery.
There you go. Our guest today, Dr. Amy Nicholson, Dr. Maria Verbrugge, from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have both of them with us. And Doug in Wanakee will give you a chance. Oh, I'm sorry, Waniwok, not Wanakee, Waniwok. Hi, Doug.
How you doing there, Mr. Miller? We've talked before.
Yes, we have.
Anywho's, my dog Trooper, 75-pound rough collie, he started experiencing that cough, and it turned into a wet cough and a lot of huffing. I took him to two different vets. One thought it was a laryngeal paralysis, something like that. And the other one thought it was probably from the wildfires, over the summer.
Oh.
Because he does go outside a lot. And I've never seen anyone address the possible wildfires, and I know they affected a lot of humans.
That's interesting. What do you think, Dr. Maria?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's just a really good example of how multifactorial sometimes this can be, looking at the effects of air quality and depending on where you are relative to the wildfires. That was a really rough time for anybody that had some underlying respiratory disease already. So I can see why why that would be definitely on our list of reasons why this particular dog might be coughing. Has your dog since recovered from this, or has this been an ongoing thing?
Well, I took him to another vet who had access to x-rays. The x-rays showed his lungs were clear, but anywho's. She gave him a two-week regimen of doxycycline, and then the other veterinarian I usually take him to said, try Benadryl. Maybe it's an allergy of some sort. And doxycycline did not seem to work at all, but the Benadryl seems to be working.
Okay. So that would, if it is, in fact, responding to the Benadryl, that would suggest that it may be a little bit of a an allergic or inflammatory type of cough. And Benadryl is something that we think of as being really quite safe. So that's really good news. And that just kind of points back to how challenging it can be to do these investigations when we have so many different reasons for dogs to cough, not just the infectious causes, but all of those others that add in and that can kind of combine with each other to make it a lot more complicated to figure out and, more difficult for the dog, too, if they have multiple things that they're kind of working with at the same time.
Doug, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Larry Mueller here with Dr. Amy Nicholson and Dr. Maria Verbrugge as we talk your pet's health here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. taking a look at your pet's health today on the show. Larry Mueller here with two guests, Dr. Amy Nicholson, a clinical assistant professor of primary care at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, and Dr. Maria Verbrugge, who's a clinical instructor of primary care at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, and also joined by Dr. Amy's dog, Vanilla Bean, who has so far not barked. So I guess Vanilla Bean is happy with the answers that she's getting as she listens in. You can join in again, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. I had a question about food and water. Should you be changing the amount of food and water you give outdoor dogs during the winter time? What do you think, Dr. Amy?
That's an interesting question. And I think it would depend a lot on how much activity they're getting between the winter and the summer. If they're really active, you know, we would presume that, you know, comparatively, you're going to be burning a lot of energy if you're outdoors during the cold weather. And especially if you're doing a lot of outdoor activities like hunting or hiking or snowshoeing, they're going to be burning a lot more walking through the snow. And accordingly, you may need to increase the amount that you're feeding to compensate for that. You would also need to make sure that obviously their water is not frozen and that they have fresh access to water that is not super cold. But if that's the thought behind it, then yes, there would be a different caloric need for different activity levels.
When I was young, my dad had a black lab, and the lab spent outside all the time. But he built an insulated doghouse and filled it with straw or whatever. And I remember going out there worried about, you know, it was really, really cold. And I stuck my hand inside the doghouse, and it was almost hot, or it felt hot, I guess, because of the striking difference. So I guess you can keep dogs outside, but more, I would guess today, in today's age, maybe unless it might be a farm animal, the dogs are all kept inside. Is that pretty true?
Yeah, for the most part, for our population of dogs, usually they spend most of their time indoors. I certainly have seen a similar situation when you look up in Alaska at the sled dogs. You know, most of those dogs are much more comfortable spending a majority of their time outdoors. But you'll notice, just like you mentioned, Larry, that they all have insulated shelters that are windproof, waterproof, that they can go into if they need to protect themselves from the really cold weather. And so I think that's important. If your dog's showing signs of, you know, shivering or hunching, those are signs that your dog's too cold and maybe not comfortable out, because we certainly are keeping most of our dogs indoors now, so they're not used to that anymore.
Speaking of those sled dogs, you never see sled dogs with booties on, or at least I don't.
Oh, when I was up there, there was an entire team with booties on.
There was.
They were all, it was, yes, yes. I know, I didn't think, I was surprised too, but they each had their individual set of booties. Yeah.
Well, I've learned something new. I thought they're outside so much, their feet get calloused or whatever, and so they're able to stand it. But apparently that's not always.
I don't think all of them did, but yeah, some of them do, yeah.
Nels in Denton, we'll go to you. Hi, Nels.
Hi. I just had a comment. That last caller was talking about his dog and possible allergies. We took our dog to the vet. He has severe allergies. His eyes water and his nose runs all the time. And they said that you can give him Citrulline or Zyrtec. However, the dose is a little bit different. She said up to 6 tablets a day. So we're giving him 3 a day, and it seems to manage it pretty well.
It's Citrulline?
Citrulline, or the same thing. It's the generic for Zyrtec.
I got
it. You can buy it over the counter, and we just grind it up and mix it with a little beef broth and pour it over his food. He loves it.
Huh.
Yeah, so that's one of the second generation antihistamines out there. So kind of a similar theory to doing Benadryl. Histamine is one of the things that mediates allergies. Oftentimes, it's a little bit more important in human allergy than it is in dog allergy. So there are definitely dogs out there where antihistamines don't really even touch their allergy. So dogs that have those itchy, watery eyes or itchy skin, it's certainly always worth trying those antihistamines because they can be effective and they can really take the edge off. And then some of the dogs that are more severe, oftentimes we do need to go look for other treatments. Definitely it is always a good idea for any over-the-counter medications. Talk to your vet first, make sure it sounds like the right thing, and get a dose from your vet because the doses that we use for humans are often not the same as they are for dogs.
All right. There you go. Nels, thank you so much. Appreciate the comment. Mary and Marinette, let's go to you. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, my question, I have a dog, and he's 5 years old. He's a golden doodle, and he has the MMM, masticatory muscle meiosis. And I didn't notice it ever. The groomer noticed it, but he has no other symptoms. He has the sunken head. He's never had any trouble opening or closing his mouth. I mean, he chews on toys, chooses food well. I'm just wondering, did he skip the other steps as far as the swelling of the head and also, where he wouldn't be able to open his mouth? He does have the atrophy, and it's pretty significant. So I'm just wondering if you've ever heard of a case like this and what can I do about it?
Yeah, so MMM, what is that? What does that again stand for? Maria?
So that is masticatory muscle myositis. So masticatory means chewing. So it's a specific muscle inflammation in the muscles that are used for chewing. So normally when we see dogs that have this condition, they are quite painful and they are not able to open their mouth. They're not able to eat. I don't know that I've ever seen a case that was kind of diagnosed after the fact like that. Amy, how about you?
I have not.
Okay, interesting. But I would think that as long as the dog is feeling good and is a cute little fluffy doodle, that's why you don't even notice how pointy their little head is once those muscles atrophy because the muscles of chewing are up on top of the head. I would think that there wouldn't really be anything more to do about that other than to watch really closely and make sure we don't progress on to any difficulty chewing.
And what happens, and this probably isn't going to happen in Mary's case of her dog, but when it gets that bad, that can't be good.
Oftentimes it can, because it's a myositis, which itis means inflammation, oftentimes they can be pretty responsive to some immune suppressive medications. So like prednisones or things like that can just get things settled right back down, and the dogs can really start to feel back to normal.
All right. Mary, thanks very much for calling. I had not heard about that particular issue. And probably a lot of other people, too, had not heard of it. So it's nice to know. Karen in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just had a comment about the booties with the dogs wearing them. It's very hard to get, especially if you don't start when they're a puppy. That makes it hard. But I had a dog that was, I assume it had to have border collie in it and very independent-minded. So what I did was let the dog decide. And when she didn't like it, I put the boots in a bag and took her for a walk. And let her decide when she started to fall down, then I'd bring them out and introduce it. And when it wouldn't work, we'd put them right away and go on. Eventually, she came right to me for that bag, you know.
Oh, well, that is an interesting approach. Dr. Amy?
That is. I love it. Kind of creating a team of training, a training team.
I think that's actually great. Thank you very much, Karen. I love that. Carly wants to know if cats can be affected by daylight savings time. Her cat seemed to be thrown off by the change in the feeding schedule and woke her up at 2:30 each day for about 3 weeks until finally getting back to the 5:30 a.m. schedule. How could she make this adjustment smoother in the future? Probably relates to her.
Yeah, I think animals would all be unanimous in hating daylight savings time, as far as all of a sudden all of the things that they're expecting is off by an hour. And it does. It takes us quite a while to get everybody back on schedule. So I think if it works for you to do so, the thing to do might be early on to try to start making that transition earlier. So kind of 10 minutes a day over the course of a week instead might help.
Just like when you're planning to travel.
Exactly.
And make that change gradually as you move along. Well, we have lots more in store for animal health questions with our two guests, Dr. Amy Nicholson, Dr. Maria Verbrugge. They'll be with us right up till 12:30. In the meantime, you can join in. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Back right after the news. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at your pet's health. I'm Larry Mueller with two guests for you today, Dr. Maria Verbrugge, clinical instructor of primary care at UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Also with us, Dr. Amy Nicholson, a clinical assistant professor of primary care at the UW School of Vet Medicine. Both are practicing veterinarians and see patients through UW Veterinary Care's primary care service. So questions for them, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Randall in Neshota, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon. My wife and I adopted a dog from a puppy mill. And for some reason, we've had her about a year now, and for some reason, she will not drink water in front of us. So, like, when we go outside or go somewhere, she'll load up with water, and then she'll end up urinating in the house. And can you think of a way we can get her to drink water in front of us?
Well, Dr. Amy, what do you think?
That's such a hard situation because there's so much that is unknown about what is just kind of a quirk that she has versus what is her prior experience and any underlying causes for this behavioral trait. I think sometimes the best way to navigate these situations is to try to gradually encourage. So whatever that looks like, whether or not it's like giving her a treat when you notice her going near a bowl, changing bowls, even like an empty bowl, putting treats in a bowl and then starting to kind of gradually moisturize it until like she feels more comfortable drinking water in front of you. But it's definitely something that is a long process in the making where it's constant positive reinforcement, constant encouraging the behavior you're trying to get. And knowing that there's probably going to be setbacks along the way if there's an underlying anxiety or concern that she has in the process.
And the peeing in the house, well, sort of a direct result.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, that's probably the most important part, right, is the peeing in the house because she's just loading up on water. And so that is something where, you know, if you can control how much water she's getting before you leave and just making sure, we certainly never want a dog to be water deplete or dehydrated. But if you can kind of control the amount of water she's drinking before you leave to try to control whether or not she's having accidents, or sometimes we do resort to pee pads in the house if she can't control herself. So that way, at least there's not a mess when you return home.
There you go, Randall. Thank you for calling. Joelle in Milwaukee will give you a chance. Hi, Joelle.
Hi. I've got a Wheaton Terrier. I'm in the car, and he's in with me, so you may hear barking. He's a great dog, but he's had the skin condition that seems to be getting worse. He gets pussy lumps under his skin. Sometimes they're like as big as a small grape. And then he scratches them, and several times he's had to be put on antibiotics because they infect. But also one time before we got to our really good vet, it went into cancer. So I'm wondering, do Wheatons get weird skin things? Is there something I can do to prevent this more?
Sounds like there may be two different things going on there, the cancer and the skin condition. What are they called?
So hard to say what it might be going on as far as the lumps that are, you know, kind of areas of infection that are either on the skin or under the skin. I would say, yeah, Wheatons are definitely a dog that I think of as having a lot of skin diseases. And so if you are, it sounds like you're working with a vet that you're very comfortable with. And so depending on what you've seen so far as, response to treatment, whether or not, using biopsy as a way to get to the root of exactly what's going on here. And a lot of times when we do our skin biopsies, we actually send them off to specifically derm pathologists, so not even just a pathology specialist, but a skin pathology specialist to look at those because skin diseases can be so unique in our dog and cat patients. Might be a good place to go to give you an idea of whether there might be a systemic medication that you can give that might help keep the skin problems under control. If you, you're in Milwaukee, so that is an area that has a fair number of specialists, there's a good chance that there is a dermatology specialist that you might be able to get in to see as well, who might help you get to the bottom of things.
Yeah. Pretty good advice. Joelle, good luck with that. Appreciate your call. Chris from Platteville emailed us. Is it harmful for a dog to spend all day in a warm house and then night sleep in a cold room that is outside temperature? Which, you know, like last night in the state, it would be, you know, could be a problem. They have an 80-pound dog. It's a mixed retriever, Doberman, Border Collie, and Mountain Dog. Once in a while, they see him shiver at night. I would think he would shiver. Amy?
Yeah, I mean, I think if he's shivering at night, that kind of tells you the story, you know, because that is a sign, an early sign of hypothermia. And so I think if he's shivering at night, it's probably too cold for him. Just like in us, you know, if we go from an inside warm temperature to an outside very cold temperature, that can be somewhat shocking on our system. And so it can be very similar for dogs, even though they have a nice outer layer. And it sounds like he's a big dog with a big coat. Certainly, if he's not used to it, it may take some adjustment. And if he's showing signs of shivering, it may not be comfortable for him at the minimum.
Maybe you have a dog house inside the room.
Absolutely. Or an insulated area that can get a little bit warmer, blankets, things like that to help keep him, give him options in terms of how warm he wants to be.
Mary wonders, she called but couldn't stay with us. She's wondering if there's a link between animal illnesses and people kissing them on the mouth.
I think as I briefly mentioned earlier, there's not a ton of crossover as far as infectious diseases or as far as infectious respiratory diseases that we can cross back and forth. And honestly, if there are a couple that do, I don't think that's going to stop me from kissing my dog on the schnoz. I think that's a pretty valuable thing to do for us. And so I would say keep doing it.
Okay. So Mary, You have the permission from University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine veterinarians that you can just go right ahead and not worry about passing anything on to your dog or maybe getting something yourself. Let's put it that way. Lucy in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, this is actually Clay from Green Bay, but Lucy's here in the car with me.
Oh.
We have an 11-year-old dog that is a great lab boxer mix. We got to meet the society. She's starting to limp a little bit. If we play with her or run with her too much, then she really seems to suffer on her front paws or legs. Our groomer recommended fish oil. Is there anything else that the veterinarians might recommend, might in the supplement range, that might help her with her joints?
So we got an older lab with seemingly joint problems, which certainly sounds like it does. What do you recommend, Dr. Amy?
I think fish oils is a great place to start. I think there's some, you know, they're very safe and there's some limited evidence that they can help with joint health. Some people will recommend glucosamine or chondroitin, and I certainly don't think it hurts. Some people swear by it. The level of evidence behind those is relatively low, so I'm not sure if it's worth the cost and return on investment, but that's certainly something else you can do. I think overall in dogs that are exhibiting signs of arthritis, probably the biggest thing we can do as they get older is making sure that they are at an appropriate weight. So I think the biggest trigger for arthritis is a dog that is overweight. So I don't know if your dog is currently well conditioned, but making sure that they are at an appropriate body condition is takes just some of the load off of the joints and a good percentage of the load. So I think that's the most important thing you can do. And then certainly, you know, at some stage, just like in humans, some dogs benefit from some anti-inflammatory pain relief. And so that's where talking to your veterinarian, if it doesn't seem like the supplements are cutting it, is a really important thing, because we have some other medications that we can give safely that are veterinary specific to help with that as well.
All right. Lucy, I'm sorry. Well, Lucy is in the car listening. So I will say, Lucy, I hope you heard that. And don't be afraid of what you're going to be getting down the road. Let's do it. Let's put it that way. Thanks again for calling. Justin in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Justin.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, we just adopted a wonderful, sweet dog through Underdog. And she's absolutely this mismatched, brindle, who knows what it is, mutt. And we've been kind of theorizing and curious about what she is. And I saw the dog DNA tests online, and I've read that they're really accurate and really good at telling you what mixes created this wonderful animal. And I've also read that they're complete and total bunk, and that we don't have the science necessarily to back up what they're saying. And I'm just curious what the opinions on that is.
Well,
that's a really good question. I think that the answer is probably somewhere in between those two. I did at least see one study comparing the tests that are out there to each other. And overall, they tended to agree with each other pretty well, as long as the dog being looked at was not a particularly unusual or rare breed. Some of like the indigenous dogs from different countries just aren't represented enough and things like that. Overall, I think that they tend to agree with each other, which makes me think that they tend to be pretty decent as far as their accuracy.
Yeah, you agree with that, Dr. Amy?
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. I think that part of it is very true. The one caution I would have is that some of them also offer like genetic testing for like specific diseases. And I think that gets really sticky. So if you're just looking to see like what kind of dog you have, I think that they do have some agreement. If you're looking for underlying risk factors, I think that becomes a little hairy.
Well, it is kind of fun, too, to see.
It is absolutely fun.
to know what's all in that animal that you're looking at and loving. So, Justin, have you been considering it? I'd say go ahead. And you guys don't have a particular one that you recommend over another? Doesn't sound like it.
No.
Yeah, I don't think that I
had. No, I did one on my dog. Yeah.
Which test did you pick, Amy?
It was very worth it, I will say. I did the wisdom panel. The wisdom panel.
Mm. The wisdom panel.
It was just a cheek swab and submitted it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was highly worth it. There was not a lot of, like, it didn't come back with, like, some of them will just say mixed breed for a decent percentage. And it may just be because she's, like, seven different breeds, but the one, my vanilla bean, came back and it was very rewarding. It was definitely worth the money for just like a week's worth of entertainment.
Okay. There you go, Justin. Feel free to open the wallet and give it a shot. Jody in Black River Falls, your turn. Hi, Jody.
Hi. We adopted a dog. He is 16 months now, but he had a trauma to his eye where he is blind. And he is not able to see out of the other eye very good. Is there something we can do so we can keep the other eye? Surgery, anything. We want to be able to have him see.
So just to clarify, sounds like we had a trauma, and so we are definitely blind in one eye. And then do you know what underlying reason is causing him to not see well out of the other eye?
No, we don't. And they did see... my vet suggested seeing an ophthalmologist.
Okay. If they're not sure why the vision is bad in the remaining eye, I'm definitely with you on, man, doing everything you can do to make sure that you're keeping that other eye healthy. And so, I think probably a trip to the ophthalmologist to identify what's going on in this in the remaining eye is a good step.
Probably it could be something that is totally unrelated to the other eye going blind.
Right.
You're saying.
Right.
So, yeah. Sounds like you're ready to spend the money to have this looked into further, Jody. And I agree with Dr. Maria. Go ahead and get yourself to an ophthalmologist. A doggy. Is there a dog ophthalmologist? Is that?
Yep, there sure are.
And they probably operate
wonderful.
About the same way the human ones, those who work with humans does.
They don't have the eye charts with the letters on them, but otherwise there's a lot of things that are pretty similar.
There you go, Jody. Thanks for calling. Catherine in Ironwood, Michigan, your turn.
Hi. I was responding to the lady and other people who call and talk about how they might get something from the pet if they're kissing them or getting saliva. And my experience was the opposite. When my dog eventually got spleen cancer and had a very, very good vet and actually took out the spleen. But he also told me before we left the office one day, he said, do not kiss the dog near the mouth or transfer saliva at all. He said, because if you're sick, then that might aggravate the cancer growth or accelerate it at any point, or infection. And I thought that was an excellent thing to tell me. I thought that was very good.
Yeah. Well, Catherine, thanks. Comments. Amy, what do you think?
I think that is a, I'm sorry that your dog had cancer. I think that, certainly when we take a spleen out, the spleen is a vital organ for helping the immune system work a little bit better. So I think it sounds like your vet was really trying to make sure that we were avoiding any potential increased exposure to an immune trigger for your dog. So.
Good point there. Catherine, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, it's not going to hurt. That's for sure. So I'm going to ask you both, what are you, one at a time here? We'll start with you, Dr. Maria. What are you seeing most often these days when your clients come in with their pets in terms of the pets themselves and health?
Oh, wow. That's a broad question. I think so at the teaching hospital, we still, we are there to help our students see everything that a general practice would see. So we'll see a lot of, a lot of wellnesses as well as sick animals. And in the past couple of years, I've really enjoyed teaching a little bit more of the spaying and the neutering to the students. Mm. That's become kind of the funnest thing at my job. So
teaching others, yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Dr. Amy?
In terms of like what we've been seeing more at the hospital?
Yeah, what have you been seeing in terms of the sicknesses and so forth?
I think honestly, even now since COVID, we've been seeing a lot of dogs coming in with some bad anxiety. And I think it started with people getting dogs during COVID, and they were around all the time. And even my dogs became very used to me working from home a lot. And then all of a sudden I came to work again in person more often, and they had some issues adjusting to that. And so I think we're still seeing some of those behavioral shifts in dogs who are used to us being around a lot and having to navigate that anxiety with their owners being gone more. So working around that.
And one other question relating to education, I have a friend of mine's daughter is in college now and a biology major and wants to be a veterinarian. And I've been told that it's harder to get into vet school than it is to get into med school in a lot of situations. What are the what's the best way to ensure that you are able to get in? Amy, what do you think?
I think the best way to make yourself as competitive as possible for getting into veterinary school, obviously, you know, there's going to be some GPA cutoffs and things like that. So you want to do well in your classes. But I think the other thing is just making yourself very diverse. So showing that you have experienced a lot of different aspects of veterinary medicine and that you know the breadth of what the field can hold is really important to set yourself out from other people, because we really do, we're such a diverse profession, and I think we really need to ensure, and I think we're very focused on making sure that diversity kind of continues into the populace as our profession moves forward.
And once you're there, that a place like UW, it sounds that Maria was talking about, you really do get exposed. Once you get in, you really get a very good education because you get to see pretty much everything that might possibly come your way in your practice.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, you see it all.
You see it all. And one final shot, Scott emailed and he says, for dogs, joints use glucosamine in addition to the fish oil.
So that's one of the things I mentioned in passing that, you know, it doesn't hurt. There's not a lot of evidence against placebo that it is helpful. But some people swear by it. Some people really think it helps. And so if that's the case, awesome. But if you're not seeing a response, then it's something that you could potentially save money and go elsewhere.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us. It's always fun and always interesting. And I appreciate your time. And I hope you'll do this again with us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Larry.
Yeah. Appreciate
thank you so much.
Appreciate it very, very much. Dr. Amy Nicholson, Clinical Assistant Professor of Primary Care at UW, and as is Dr. Maria Verbrugge, who's a Clinical Instructor of Primary Care at UW School of Veterinary Medicine, both of them. And we'll have them back, and we will talk with them again. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Phenology, a study of changing seasons, and there's a new calendar out we'll be talking about on the show. And then we'll talk about the PBS Around the Farm Table special. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.